Hello, and welcome to The Complete History of Science, Series 5, Episode 4, Nicholas Copernicus Part 2, On the Revolutions. On a dark and cold evening, in May of 1539, Nicholas Copernicus received an unexpected visitor. Joachim de Porus, known as Reticus, was a mathematician from the University of Wittenberg. Reticus was around 25 years old and something of a prodigy, having become a professor of mathematical astronomy at 22. By contrast, Copernicus was 66 years old, grey-haired and feeling the pains of age. He was also unused to receiving guests such as Reticus. In the 30 years since he wrote the little commentary, Copernicus had published exactly nothing. He had never been attached to a university, and had never lectured on astronomy. Unlike his friend, Tiedemann Gies, who was now bishop of a neighbouring diocese, Copernicus was still a canon at Fronborg Cathedral. He had spent his entire career quietly working on his administrative duties, such as calculating and collecting rents across the diocese of Varmia. Despite this, Copernicus still had some reputation. In 1539, Reticus was on a break from university, and likely he first heard of Copernicus while visiting the free imperial city of Nuremberg. Reticus was travelling across Europe, looking to meet fellow mathematicians, and chose the bustling city of Nuremberg as it was one of the continent's intellectual hubs. Thanks in part to the legacy of Regiomontanus, the city was also a great centre of book publishing. Reticus befriended a man here, Johannes Petraeus, who was among the leading printers of astronomical works in Europe, having published texts by Regiomontanus. He also met Johann Schoner, a maker of astronomical instruments, as well as a cartographer and a geographer. Reticus bonded with Schoner over a shared passion for astrology, and it was during their discussions Reticus learned of Copernicus. Since around 1510, Copernicus's heliocentric theory had been known amongst friends and acquaintances, and copies of his little commentary circulated between enthusiasts. Many of his close friends, Bishop Gies foremost amongst them, had urged him to publish, but time and again, Copernicus had refused. Word of his cosmology spread, and even reached the Vatican, where a friend of Copernicus worked as a secretary to a cardinal. In 1533, in the shade of the Vatican gardens, this friend presented the heliocentric model to the cardinals and the Pope. The reception was favourable, and one of these cardinals wrote to Copernicus, urging him to give more detail. But even this grand overture failed to motivate him into action. Copernicus must have seemed at this time a mysterious and perhaps reclusive character, whose strange idea was likely discussed as an interesting curio rather than a serious theory. Reticus, however, was a natural reactionary and was immediately taken with the idea of a heliocentric universe. He was determined to learn more, and so with typical youthful exuberance, took the bold decision to make the 1,000-kilometre journey northeast to Fronborg on the frozen Baltic Sea. He carried with him a letter of introduction from Schoner, but even so, the welcome he would receive was uncertain. Copernicus had never had a student, and aside from Bishop Gies, no close confidants. There were also greater reasons he might receive a frosty reception. In the 16th century, the church was in the process of fracturing, as Martin Luther, with the backing of several German princes, was forming the new Protestant church. Reticus, a professor at Luther's own university in Wittenberg, was a Protestant, and therefore might not be welcomed in Catholic Poland. On arriving at Copernicus's doorstep in Fronborg, Reticus produced his letter of introduction from Schoner, and several beautifully bound mathematical works, gifts from the print shop of Petraeus. Perhaps even more precious, he also brought some observations made by Schoner of the planet Mercury. Whether or not this won over Copernicus, we don't know, but soon Reticus, exhausted from his journey, became severely ill. Copernicus took him in and used his medical knowledge to nurse him back to health. After recovering, Reticus stayed, and the two men began to talk astronomy. Copernicus must have been initially reserved. He had only previously discussed his theory with his closest friends, and harboured a deep uncertainty about how it would be received by the outside world. In Reticus, however, he found an enthusiastic student and a mathematician of equal stature. Over the next several months, Copernicus warmed to Reticus and brought him into his confidence. The older astronomer revealed to the younger man that for the past decade he had been secretly working on a great new work outlining the details of his heliocentric theory. In fact, he had completed a large portion of it already. This was the book Copernicus had wanted to write for 30 years, the book which would replace the Almagest. Reticus was allowed to read the manuscript and must have felt the great effort of travelling to Fromborg had been worthwhile. Poring over these pages revealed that his teacher had not only worked out a new heliocentric system, but he had solved most of the lingering problems in Ptolemaic astronomy. By the end of the summer, Reticus had learnt enough of Copernicus's theories to write back to Schoner in Nuremberg. He described Copernicus's work as 6 books imitating Ptolemy and embracing the whole of astronomy. Interestingly, this letter didn't lead with what we may consider the most salient detail. Reticus does not mention heliocentricity until page 19. Perhaps he was trying to hide this controversial detail. Or perhaps he, and by extension Schoner, wouldn't have considered this to be the most important revelation of the new work. In the first section of the letter, Reticus instead discusses Copernicus's new model for the precession of the equinoxes, as well as changes in the long-term cycles of the sun's position. Writing to a fellow astrologer, he links these cycles to great turning points in world history and predicts the second coming of Jesus when the sun makes a full cycle. Next, Reticus outlines the prominent astronomical problems which the new work solved. For example, he reports that Copernicus had created models for the moon and planets without resorting to the use of an equant. Likewise, he solved the issue with Ptolemy's lunar model, which had suggested the moon's diameter should be twice as large at some points in its cycle compared to others. These issues had of course already been solved by Al-Shatir 200 years before, but his work was little known in the West. To Reticus and Schoner, these were long-standing problems, and a solution would have caused much excitement in the astronomical community. By the time he comes to discuss the planets, however, Reticus could no longer avoid discussion of heliocentricity. He begins to defend the idea immediately, writing, "Indeed, there is something divine in the circumstance that a sure understanding of the celestial phenomena must depend on the regular and uniform motion of the terrestrial globe." The purpose of the letter, it seems, was to test the acceptability of the new theory. On receiving the letter, and with Copernicus's permission, Schoner had it published, calling it the Narrativo Primo, or in English, the first account, and copies of the printed letter were sent across Europe. On the whole, the reception was favourable, and congratulatory notes flooded in from scholars across the continent. This must have been some relief for Copernicus, while Reticus realised he was about to become famous. Rheticus received a request to return to Wittenberg to lecture on the new theory. This was timely, as the Bishop of Varmia was threatening to enforce an anti-Protestant decree, which would have expelled Protestants like Rheticus from the territory. The publication of the first account, then, may have been a premature ending to the collaboration between Rheticus and Copernicus, if not for the intervention of Tiedemann Gies. For decades, Gies had watched his friend work on his theories in private, without ever coming close to publishing. Rheticus, however, had spurred Copernicus into action, and Gies worried that without him, Copernicus would once again lose faith in the project. Despite the positive reception of the first account, Copernicus was still not completely committed to publication. Copernicus was by nature a careful and instinctively conservative man. For 30 years, he was troubled by doubt, worried about the reaction to the heliocentric model, particularly from a religious perspective. In the Bible, Joshua had commanded the sun to stand still, implying that usually it was in motion. Likewise, Psalm 93 had proclaimed that the earth remained forever unmoved. Copernicus was worried that if his ideas were published, he may be attacked by those who took the Bible literally. Watching the hesitation again stir in his friend, Tiedemann Gies set out to ensure that Rheticus would remain. Unlike Copernicus, Rheticus was young, bold, and naturally rebellious, happy to swim against the current. Fortunately, as Bishop of Culm, Gies now had some influence, and asked the Grand Duke to take Rheticus into his protection. This convinced Rheticus to stay in Fronborg and continue to work with Copernicus. During this time, they made observations together, watching a partial solar eclipse, which occurred on the 7th of April, 1540. 16 months later, in August 1541, Rheticus was still there, and they watched another partial solar eclipse, the last one Copernicus would observe during his lifetime. Between these observations, they reworked the first 6 books, checking the calculations and making the proofs clearer. Alongside this astronomical work, a period of politicking ensued. Tiedemann Gies, now joined by Rheticus, encouraged Copernicus to publish. This effort was helped by the steady stream of letters they were still receiving in response to the first account. The Bishop of Varmia, Copernicus's superior, even received a letter from a well-known Dutch mathematician, which seems to have persuaded the bishop to get behind Copernicus's project. In May 1541, Rheticus and Copernicus received a letter from a man called Andreas Osiander, a theologian and astronomical enthusiast. He was a friend of the printer Petreus in Nuremberg and was keen to see Copernicus's work published. His opinion was that the work was a mathematical one, whose place was to improve computation. This was a common position, as many viewed Ptolemy's epicycles and equants as merely computational devices rather than representing physical reality. This argument, however, was not one that appealed to Copernicus. Copernicus believed in the physical reality of the model. That is, he truly believed the Earth really did move. Nevertheless, Osiander's argument was a shield which assuaged his fears, and so, in 1541, he finally agreed to publish. Rheticus was to personally deliver the completed manuscript to the printers in Nuremberg, leaving in early autumn 1541. He would never return to Fronborg and would never see Copernicus again. He later wrote, "There has been no greater human happiness than my relation with so excellent a man as he." However, before delivering the manuscript, he needed to return to Wittenberg where he was made Dean of the Faculty of Arts. Rheticus remained in Wittenberg, busy with administration and teaching, for the rest of the year. It wasn't until May 1542 that he finally found time to travel to Nuremberg and deliver the manuscripts into the hands of the printer Petreius. He stayed checking the proofs until mid-October, when he was once again required to leave, as he had accepted a professorship in mathematics from the University of Leipzig. Back in Fromburg, Copernicus's doubts about publication had re-emerged, and he sought reassurance. He appealed to the highest religious authority of all, the Pope, asking for permission to dedicate the work to him. He wrote, "I can readily imagine, Holy Father, that as soon as people hear I ascribe certain motions to the terrestrial globe, they will immediately shout to have me and my opinions hooted off stage." In the letter, he explained his dissatisfaction with the eccentrics and equants of the Almagest and appealed to the Pope's sense of divine beauty, promoting his own more elegant model in place of Ptolemy's cumbersome system. His intent was to seek protection and was encouraged when his request was granted. He sent the Pope's dedication to the printers in June 1542, along with some corrections he wished to make. Over the next few months, Copernicus continued commenting and returning notes on the pages he received back from the printers. However, this routine was abruptly stopped in late autumn, when Copernicus suffered a stroke which left him paralyzed and unable to speak. He would linger through the winter, but could eat little, and there was nothing to be done. According to Bishop Gies, on the 24th of March 1543, as the final pages were delivered from Nuremberg, Nicolaus Copernicus died. He was laid to rest under his altar in Fromburg Cathedral, and as was custom, no marker or epitaph marked the spot. The work was ready for publication, but during his illness, some changes had been made in Nuremberg. The original title, On the Revolutions, was changed to On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres. Even more significant, an anonymous introduction was inserted, stating that the author was not claiming that the hypothesis of a moving earth was necessarily true. Instead, it merely produces calculations in agreement with observations. By the time these alterations came to light, Copernicus was already gone. However, Bishop Gies, troubled by the changes, wrote to Rheticus immediately, asking for them to be removed. Unfortunately, Rheticus had already travelled on to Leipzig, and the man responsible was Andreas Osiander, who had been left in charge of proofreading. Osiander had written to Copernicus many years before with the same argument, and added the introduction as he believed it would protect the work from criticism. Gies, nevertheless, was outraged. He knew Copernicus, and he knew that this was not his opinion. Despite Gies's anger, it was too late to remove the introduction, and Osiander was proven correct, as no serious organized resistance appeared over the succeeding decades. In fact, it can be argued that the immediate impact of the work was very slight. It sold, but the first run of 400 books didn't sell out. Copernicus was imitating the Almagest, and like the Almagest, it was simply too technical a work for most people. It was primarily read by astronomers, and often those who did read it highlighted other details over heliocentricity. In particular, many were impressed by Copernicus's models eliminating the need for an equant. One admirer was Rheticus's colleague in Wittenberg, Erasmus Reinhold, who wrote on the title page of his copy, "Celestial motion is circular and uniform. a reference to Copernicus's equantless model. Reinhold also used Copernicus's models to calculate new astronomical tables, called the Prussian tables, which would replace those based on the Almagest. To most practitioners, this was still the most important aspect of astronomy, because predicting planetary orbits was key to astrology. As it turns out, however, there was little advantage to these new calculations, which were no more accurate than Ptolemy's had been. The impact of On the Revolutions, then, is best judged not in years, but in decades. It was reprinted in 1566 and 1617, and was read by all of the great astronomers of the next century. In the years after Copernicus's death, very few people believed that the Earth revolved around the Sun, but by the end of the 17th century, virtually every great thinker did. Over the next century, the ideas of Aristotle, which had held such a central place in medieval European thought, would be replaced by both new ideas and new ways of acquiring knowledge. This is sometimes called the scientific revolution, and while it was a slow process, it undoubtedly changed how people viewed the world. Copernicus, perhaps unknowingly, had taken a sledgehammer to the vast edifice which Aristotle had constructed. Piece by piece, and brick by brick, his successors would take apart this structure until nothing was left, and instead, a vast forest came into view.